Our song for the evening is Psalm 130, a song of ascents, a pilgrim song. Out of the depths I have cried to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. If you, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? So there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I do hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than those who watch for the morning. Yes, more than those who watch for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy, and with him is abundant redemption. And he shall redeem Israel from all his iniquities. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So many of the Psalms start out with, Lord, hear my voice, to one degree or another, saying that message. It almost becomes like window dressing. You don't think of it, it's just a standard part of the Psalm. But to not think of it is quite a mistake. We take for granted that God will hear us when we pray. When we consider prayer, we jump immediately to the issue of its answer without contemplating that God is most free, as our confession puts it. He is free to do what he wants. God is not an automation so that he must hear our prayer. God is free. To see that, one only need walk through the book of Jeremiah. In that fairly forgotten book of the Bible, and yet so very important, there's a running theme throughout the first part of the book, which can be very disturbing when you first hit it. Consider these passages from the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 7, verse 15 to 16. I will cast you out of my sight as I have cast out all your brethren, the whole posterity of Ephraim. Therefore, do not pray for this people, nor lift up a cry or prayer for them, nor make intercession to me, for I will not hear you, says God to the prophet. A few verses later, in Jeremiah 11, verse 13 and 14, we read this. According to the number of your cities were your gods, O Judah, and according to the number of the streets of Jerusalem, you have set up altars to that shameful thing, altars to burn incense to Baal. So do not pray for this people or lift up a cry or prayer for them, for I will not hear them in the time that they cry out to me because of their trouble. And just in case Jeremiah had not gotten the message, in chapter 14, verse 11 to 12, we read this. Then the Lord said to me, do not pray for this people or for their good. When they fast, I will not hear their cry, and when they offer burnt offering and grain offering, I will not accept them, but I will consume them by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. Three times. Don't pray for this people. If you pray for them, I won't listen. Now, the quick answer of the modern evangelical is to say, oh, but that's the Old Testament. Grace is lesser in the Old Testament. God does things totally different now. That is the God of wrath, but the God of grace would never act that way. Well, when you turn to the New Testament, to the book of 1 Peter, you read this rather surprising word from God in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Husbands, likewise, dwell with them, that is your wives, with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, as being heirs together the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. The context is husband to wives, but the possibility is God may choose to not listen to your prayers. So be careful in this matter, husbands, and be kind to your wives. God is most free. God chooses to listen to our prayers or not. I remember being a younger child, I remember being in my teens, and hearing a fairly good sermon on prayer, where the preacher said there were three possible answers the Lord might give to our praying. Yes, no, or wait. And all three answers are true, but I would add to his list one more, which is, what? God might choose not to listen. The psalmist has two great reasons to pray and beg God to hear him. The first one is that he needs to make supplication, says our text. A supplication is a cry of need. Whatever condition he is in a needy one. He knows that he is in a needy condition, and God can meet his needs, and apparently God alone. And so he is begging God to hear him. Secondly, he is, quote, in the depths. Out of the depths I cried to you. That is the imagery of being confined, of being in a hole, of being trapped, of being in a place of darkness. It can have several meanings. The imagery fits a number of circumstances. Our psalm defines what it means further down. It's a short psalm. Did you notice that in so short a psalm, we encounter the word iniquities twice? In verse 3, if you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, and in verse 8, and he shall redeem Israel from all his iniquities. That seems to be the focus of him being entrapped. He is in a place of darkness. He is in a place of confinement because his iniquities serve to make it so. Surely you understand the imagery. The sin which seems so much to be our tool has become our master, and we are closed in our iniquities. And the psalmist now knows that this condition he is in leads him to be needy, and so there is a linkage between the two. He is making supplication because he's in the depths because of his iniquities. He is like the prodigal in the pig pen. He is not the prodigal at the height of his rebellion, enjoying his sin, not noticing that he is digging a hole into which he now cannot escape. He is among the pigs. He is feeding the pigs. He is starving. He is in great distress, and he is crying out to God, O Lord, hear my prayer, which you do not have to do, but please do. One has to pity the backslider. He is most in need of his God at that particular moment. At least he is most aware of his need. And yet in his sin, he feels in the depths. He feels entombed. He feels most far from his God at the moment when he senses his greatest need. It is nearly impossible to hear such words and not think of the prophet Jonah. Jonah's famous prayer in chapter 2 of his book. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the fish's belly. Now that's about as deep a depth as you can get. And he said, I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. Then I said, I have been cast out of your sight. Yet I will look again towards your holy temple. Being thrown into the sea, into the depths, finally swallowed by a large fish, it all was very physically telling of his spiritual estate. He was in the depths. His iniquity in running away from God had led to him really being in the depths, but he was in the depths long before he was ever in the fish, and now God providentially was making him aware of what he already was. I've been there. I don't know if you have or not. But I have been in that twilight moment where I most needed the Lord and I felt most cut off from him. It is a sickening feeling to have in the pit of your stomach. In that day, saying to God, God, you must hear me because that's what you do. That's the machine that you are, you always hear me, doesn't really cut it. God is most free. And God's holiness is no light thing. In verse 3, God's holiness is very clear. If you should mark iniquities, O Lord, who can stand? God's holiness, His righteousness, His perfection, all of it in the day of backsliding suddenly becomes a terror, as it should, if the need for supplication has become known. The prophet Habakkuk, dealing with God's holiness in chapter 1 and verse 3, defined God in these words: "You are of purer eyes than to behold evil, and you cannot look on wickedness." His purity is such that God's perfection doesn't even let him look at it. And here you are, a backslider, standing in the presence of the utter, absolute, holy God, the God who shall act on Judgment Day. In Revelation chapter 20, and verse 11 to 15, we get a picture of that holiness. "Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which was the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire," this is the second death, "and anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." That's a holy God. The record account of all men's deeds are laid out before him, and nobody passes. Not a single one. It is only if they're in a different book that is not affected by this burning holiness. With such a God, what then is the backslider's hope? And what should his plea be to be heard? We find that in verse 4. In verse 4, after saying that if God writes down my sins, I'm done for, he says, "But there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared." Fear is to tremble with fright. It's to be struck with the awe of something, to truly be overwhelmed with its majesty to the point of feeling a certain horror. Pagans have a feeling of awe and fear of their gods. And quite frankly, maybe they should. In the book of Jude, for instance, we read somewhat puzzling words. Jude, verse 8 and 9 says, "Likewise also these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries," and that's a word for spiritual beings. "Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when disputing about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" Jude is talking about spiritual beings. He is talking about false teachers who make light of spiritual beings, and he is saying they really ought to have a certain fear of this. Michael the archangel doesn't act with swagger to the devil. But these men, in the presence of these spiritual entities that they worship, devilish entities, make light of them, and men probably ought not do that, considering the relative power of men and spiritual beings. But as much as pagans might be right to fear the spirits they worship, our God is even more fearful. He is even more ominous. To fear him for his power and his glory is mere wisdom. it seems self-evident that that would be wise. But in our psalm, the psalmist says, that which truly brings fear and reverence and awe, that which overwhelms me with its power and majesty, is that unlike pagan deities, our God has the capacity to forgive. You see, overwhelmingly, the gods are presented as rather, how shall I say it, petty. They are all powerful. They own the world. They're not really given to forgiveness. They expect to be served. With but a whim, they can wipe away man. But they don't show compassion. They don't show love. They don't show forgiveness. Our God, the true God, the origin of every spirit and every man, our God is so big, so awesome, so above pettiness, that his grandeur extends to the fact that he forgives. He can be holy, he is holy, and yet he can be gracious. It is as much a part of his character as his holiness is. Now, it is not more than his holiness is. That mistake is often made. Oh, God is forgiving, so he is not holy. Au contraire, the psalmist would not have you believe that. God is holy, but he is just as gracious. In God, the two merge perfectly, seamlessly, blindingly, overwhelmingly. Such a God is to be feared. Where do you encounter this grace? We find it in verse 5b. In your word, I do hope. God is most free. He can do anything he wants. But God has spoken. He has spoken a word. And this word is a covenantal word. It is a promise. God self-limits in that he enters into the covenant. The backslider trusts his God to be gracious because God has promised to do so in his word. In Hebrews, we are told it is impossible for God to lie. This is not an impossibility in that he doesn't have the power to do it. It is an impossibility because it is against his nature to do it. God has spoken. God has promised to be gracious. Here is the hope of the backslider. And a great hope it is. The psalmist believes God will forgive him. He finds great comfort in that. And see how he behaves after his supplications have been raised. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits. My soul waits for the Lord more than those who watch for the morning. Yes, more than those who watch for the morning. I wait. God's answer may not come in a fortnight. God may hear a prayer and respond and give an answer that to the human being seems very long in coming indeed. But it is of the essence of faith to wait. In the book of Daniel, in chapter 9 and 10, you hit a strange example of this. In chapter 9, Daniel is a prayer. We read, in the first year of Darius the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. Then I set my faith towards the Lord God to make requests by prayer and supplications with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. And then further in that chapter, there is a response, and it's rather quick. Now, while I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sin and the sins of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God from the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. And he goes on to explain it. But Daniel is praying, and God dispatches an angel, and the angel appears. It's rather quick. But then in the very next chapter, in chapter 10, beginning at verse 10, Daniel is at prayer again, and the response comes like this. Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking the word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the king of Persia. Now, these are spiritual events taking place, and I don't mean to explain perfectly how angels do their business in their warfare. But God is most free and most powerful. God can deal with any prince of Persia. And in the first chapter, Daniel prays, and God answers his prayer in a very dramatic way by the evening time. And in the next chapter, it is God's good pleasure to let that which is devilish have its way for 21 days. Daniel has been praying. Daniel has been seeking God. And God allows this time period to take place. Why? We don't really know. But God is most free. God is most powerful. And Daniel is praying in both cases. And in one case, he waits. How we expect our prayers to be so quickly answered. It would be cliche to say that we have become an instant culture. We know that. We are the kind of people that wonder why the microwave takes so long. The essence of faith is being willing to wait. My hope is in the Lord. I wait for the Lord. I'm like the watchman on the city walls looking for sunrise. In the dark, I'm endangered. I'm looking for the sunlight to come and say I'm okay. I'm not really anxious, but I'm trusting it's going to come. I'm looking forward to it, and I am willing to wait. So the psalmist says, he lifts up his supplications. He is in the depths. His prayer will be heard by his covenant God. He is assured of that. But waiting may well be part of what he must do. Now, a man who knows that God is gracious, that God has willed himself to show unmerited favor to his people, wants a church that knows that grace. The psalm ends with the psalmist turning to Israel and saying, O Israel, hope in the Lord. Notice he does not turn to the world and say, O nations of men, trust in the Lord. Now, there'll be a place for that. There are other psalms that do that. But at the end of Psalm 130, he turns to Israel. He turns to the church of God, and he says, O church of God, trust in the Lord. My sermon this morning talked about a worldly religion that is still inside the visible church. It is not simply pagan religions. It is in the very church of God, a worldly, political, compromising, pragmatic religion that has nothing to do with God at all. It is there in the Christian church. It is there in the covenant community. The psalmist has known grace. He has known the goodness of God, and he turns to his fellow churchmen in an act of reformation. And he says, O Israel, trust in the Lord. He is righteous. He goes through all the themes that in his despair he has examined, and he puts it forward to the church of God and says, trust in the Lord, wait upon the Lord, he will redeem Israel from their iniquities. Who better should know but a backslider who has been redeemed from his iniquities? God will do this. Oh, church, know the goodness of God. It is important to note the context of this psalm. We have done it a time or two. But these are songs to be sung on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. This is a backslider's song. He has nevertheless gone on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. He has gone to the three great feasts. The Christian worship on Sabbath day that we perform is the fulfillment of those feasts. We are at the feast right now. This is a song for the backslider to come to the feast. The backslider may feel, I am in the depths, I am sealed away from God. The very last place I should be is at the feast with the faithful in worship. But this psalm is given to backsliders to sing as to the feast they go. The backslider most of all should be in the presence of the covenant people and the covenant God. Have you backslidden? Have you transgressed against the law of God? Do you know what it's like to be in that debt, to be one who has committed iniquity? Do you feel separated from God? Get thee to the church. It is where you need to be. You may feel most out of place, but this is where you most should be. Because our God is gracious. Our God will extend unmerited favor. Our God has promised in the covenant to receive us. Our God passed between the pieces without us going. Our God keeps the covenants. Come, O backslider. Come, O failure, to the feast. And of course, last but most importantly, we must ask, where is Jesus in this psalm? Well, it should be of all psalms most evident. This is a psalm celebrating the grace of God, the unmerited favor of God, the covenant grace of God. Where else do we find that but in Jesus? Grace is being dead in trespasses and sins in which you once walked. But God, who is rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together in Christ. It is Christ who brings us from death to life, and it is Christ who washes our feet. We are all, at some point, going to sing this psalm. We will be in the depths, we will be the backslider, we will have failed. And it is in Jesus Christ that God extends his grace. This is a psalm of Christ like no other, because it is a psalm of grace.